Welcome to the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. This week we're going to be talking about what it's like running for Parliament. In the past few days I've been speaking to two candidates that stood and lost for Labour in 2015. I spoke to Russell Whiting, who stood in the challenging, or Tory stronghold, seat of Suffolk Coastal, and also James Frith, who stood in the marginal Bury North. I was interested in their journey, their experiences, and why they thought Labour lost. I'm also interested in understanding a bit more about the types of people that run for Parliament, how they get into it, and whether or not we're genuinely producing a Parliament that is representative of the country. I think most people would suggest that that's probably not the case. And I guess the big question then becomes, if we aren't, why aren't we? I was also interested to get their views, as I mentioned, on why Labour lost. And completely accidentally, I got two different views from them, which is quite interesting. But we'll come to that a bit later. So I started off by speaking to Russell Whiting, who, as I say, stood in Suffolk Coastal, and asked about his experiences there. And he started off by telling me how he got selected. So, Russell, welcome to Polling Matters. First of all, it might be quite a good idea to get a bit of background about yourself and how you ended up standing for Suffolk Coastal, maybe the process you went through to do that.
Well, thanks for having me, Kieran. So I was born in the constituency, lived there until I went to university, and then for a very brief time afterwards. My family history goes back 350 years in the constituency. I joined the Labour Party in 2010, after campaigning with Nick Palmer in Broxtow, and really thought that you know, the best way to fight back against the Conservative and Lib Dem coalition was to stand for Parliament and make a difference within the Labour Party. And what better place to do than the constituency that I know and love so well?
And what sort of process do you have to go through? And obviously, different parties have different situations. So, what do you do? Send in an application form, or how does it work?
All selections are advertised on the website. I submitted my application. You then have to be shortlisted by branch members locally. This actually happened while I was in Tunisia on holiday, so got a very delighted email in the early hours of the morning telling me that I'd gone through to the next stage. You then have a shortlisting meeting with key members of the constituency party, who interviewed me for about an hour and asked me various questions. And then three people made it through to the selection meeting, where any member of the party in the constituency can come. We gave 10-minute speeches, and then we answered about an hour of questions and answers. And then it was a vote, private ballot, alternative vote system, and I won by 7 votes from my nearest challenger.
Excellent. And I mean, presumably, for those listening that don't necessarily know Suffolk Coastal constituency very well, I was doing some research before we spoke. It's obviously, as you might expect, anyone with a sort of working knowledge of politics, you know, a sort of die-hard Conservative seat. So it must have been a sort of strange situation for you, because you kind of have this idea that, you know, it's great to be standing for Parliament, but you're kind of reasonably certain you're not going to win. I mean, how did you kind of deal with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, is that listeners will know, it's the seat where John Selwyn Gummer was MP for a good number of years, famously fed his daughter the beef burger during the BSE crisis. The majority, I think, was about 9,000 that the Tories had over the Lib Dems. Labour, a very distant third after 2010. It's really important in those kind of areas that the Labour Party, the Labour movement, has a voice, and that was one of my aims, to be a strong voice for them. It's important that people are held to account, and that's one of the things that I really wanted to do after the 5 years that the MP had. But also, you know, it's a great experience for me. If I ever did want to stand again, there's a lot that I take from that. And we were also able to really help in neighbouring key constituencies, Ipswich and Waveney, which were the seats that Labour would have had to win were they to get anywhere near winning a majority.
And I see you actually increased the vote share by 2%, so not a terrible result in the grand scheme of things.
That's right. We got above 10,013.
Was that something of a target for you, to try and sort of clear 10,000, or do you not really have any expectations?
No. The three clear targets I set myself were to get back into second place, to get over 10,000, and to beat UKIP. And after the campaign we had in Suffolk Coastal and nationally, where a UKIP candidate was parachuted in from the Isle of Wight and given, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds, billboards across the constituency, paid army of leafleters, it was really satisfying to push them into third place.
Yeah, presumably that was a, well, maybe not a seat they thought they'd win, but it was sort of classic UKIP territory, really, isn't it? Sort of conservative seat by the coast, possibly somewhere they might do well.
2014 European elections, I believe, in the local authority, which is slightly different to the constituency, UKIP only lost out to the Tories by about 350 votes. So they were really, you know, really bigging up their chances. And then at about 2 a.m. they started talking about coming second. And then at about 4:30 they finally conceded that they were going to come third.
So walk me through the kind of, I don't know, your kind of experiences as being a candidate. So, I mean, when were you selected in relation to when the election was?
I was, I obviously remember very well, Friday the 13th of September 2013. So
you had a good long while in the run-up to it, knowing you were a candidate.
That's right. So we had, obviously, kind of two stages. We were building up to the European elections from September to May 2014, where we were very hopeful that Labour would win at least one additional seat in the East to the one that we had. And then we kind of took a very short break over the summer of 2014, and then we started ramping up towards the general election campaign, despite the fact that it was a, well, they call them challenging seats. Realistically, it was a hopeless seat for a Labour candidate. That, you know, we had frequently 15, 20 people out canvassing. We leafleted the entire constituency. And we also had local elections at the same time. So there was a lot of activity building up, both to 2014 and 2015. So yeah, it was very busy, you know, very busy time.
And presumably, I mean, you're this candidate at the same time as what, being a student or doing a full-time job? I mean, what's the day-to-day for you?
I was working full-time for an animal rights group in London, splitting my time between London and Suffolk. So I would travel down typically on a Sunday night, Monday morning, do a full working week, either replying to emails or planning campaigning or telephone canvassing Monday to Friday evening, and then either Friday evening or Saturday morning travelling up to Suffolk, up the A12, and then a full day of campaigning Saturday and Sunday, and then back down again for the week. So I think I was only full-time campaigning for about the last 3 or 4 weeks, but typically the last 6 months of the campaign I was probably doing 75, 80 hours a week.
I mean, and obviously that represents something of a challenge. I mean, what do you think, having had the experience you've had, I mean, what do you think the biggest challenges are for people that decide they want to throw their hat into the ring and become a member of Parliament? And obviously getting selected is one of them, but it sounds like it's a hard slog, and, you know, you were commuting from London to Suffolk to an extent at weekends, but not everyone can do that, of course.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I was really surprised by the financial commitments of even getting selected. I mean, I was expected to send a leaflet in the post to every member of the constituency. I think off the top of my head, there were over 300. So it cost about £175 in postage. I was very fortunate that I had the personal resources to do that, but that's a massive a massive hurdle. And then the time, you know, the time commitments. I was very fortunate that work was flexible. If I needed to go up in the evening to attend meetings, to have time off at very short notice, we only had one shadow cabinet visit to the constituency, but I was phoned up on, you know, 6 o'clock the night before and said, can you be somewhere at 9 o'clock the next morning? Not many people have jobs that enable them to just phone up at 8:30 in the morning and say, I'm not coming in today because I'm, you know, in Suffolk. So these, in addition to the time constraints, these are the key things I think that we need to look at when we're trying to increase representation in politics.
Because, I mean, one of the things that not just Labour but all parties talk about is trying to get more working class people into Parliament, or, you know, not just working class people, but lots of different, lots of people that have different types of lifestyle from different walks of life, I guess. It's quite difficult. I mean, it feels like the current way that people run for Parliament makes it quite likely you're going to end up with very similar types of people in it. Would that be fair?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, even the fact that we have a hustings meetings where you have to speak for 10 minutes, if that's the first time that you've ever spoken for 10 minutes in public and you're up against someone who does a day-to-day job where they're used to speaking publicly and they're used to speaking in persuasive terms, I'm very fortunate that I've done that for the last 7 years since I graduated. That is a huge advantage that is built into the system for people like me who do political jobs. So I think if we want people in Parliament and to be standing for Parliament from other backgrounds, you know, that's something else that we need to look at.
And presumably canvassing is a sort of, you know, knocking on people's doors and things like that is obviously part of it. I guess you could argue that if you want to be representative of people, then you're going to have to sort of get used to that. But I mean, how did you find canvassing in a seat that is quite clearly a sort of Conservative stronghold? I mean, presumably you were targeting very specifically where you were going, or I mean, did you find it quite demoralising and difficult, or did you just sort of take it on the chin?
Well, I pride myself on the fact that I knocked on at least, you know, 50 doors in every town and every village in the constituency. But you're right, we kind of targeted broadly Felixstowe, which is the main town in the south of the constituency, the biggest container port in the UK, 3,000 unionised workers, so should be a Labour stronghold. Then there's Leiston, which used to elect communist members to the town council and is actually known as Little Moscow locally. And then Halesworth in the kind of north of the constituency. It's actually in Waveney district, but again, a kind of traditional working class market town. I think the kind of two or three overall impressions, people were surprised to see that there was a functioning Labour Party locally. I think some of these places, you know, haven't had a Labour Party member knock on their door for a long time. I spoke to a lot of people who I knew, obviously, being a Felixstowe boy, lots of people who... I had one woman who said, "I've got no interest in voting for the Labour Party, but your sister's just made my son's wedding cake, so I suppose I should support her brother as he's standing in the general election." Lots of my old teachers who live in much nicer houses than I ever thought they would. And very few people who, you know, sort of told me in no uncertain terms where to go. I think there was only a couple. I think in the run-up to the election, as it got closer, people were really kind of keen to discuss and debate issues on the doorstep, and I kind of like to think that I always gave a straight answer to a straight question, and I think some people liked that and some people didn't.
And presumably you mentioned earlier you were going around different constituencies to try and help people, which, you know, to be honest, would have had maybe a better shot of winning. I mean, from your general campaigning, your general experiences, I mean, what do you think really held Labour back? Because it's obviously a very intense debate in the Labour Party during the leadership contest, and I guess it won't go away, will it, in terms of you know, where the Labour Party goes from here. I mean, what were you picking up on the doorstep? And, you know, did you ever get a feeling in your bones, so to speak, that maybe the election wasn't going to go as well as the polls seemed to think it might be at the time?
I think the overriding issue in Ipswich and Waveney, which were the two key seats I spent most time in, and various other seats around the region and in my own, was you're all the same. Why would I bother voting for Labour or Conservative when you're just going to do the same thing? So therefore, I am either A, not going to vote, or B, I'm going to vote UKIP as a plague on all your houses type thing. Or, you know, there's still lots of people who haven't forgiven the Labour Party for the Iraq War and other perceived sellouts of the Blair governments. The main message that kept coming across was you're not putting forward an alternative to what you are saying the Conservatives and the Lib Dems are doing wrong, i.e. austerity. That's basically what it was. And I think in my constituency and in so many others, the fact that Labour lost thousands of votes to UKIP and to apathy and some to the Green Party was masked by the fact that we got kind of enough from the Lib Dems to cover that, you know, to cover that kind of shortfall. In my own constituency, off the top of my head, I haven't checked the figures recently, but I think the Conservative vote went up by about 3,000. Mine went up by about 3,000. The UKIP vote went up by about 9,000, and the Lib Dem vote completely collapsed, I think, by about 10 or 11. So I don't think it's as easy to say all the, you know, Labour vote held firm and we got some more. I think we lost a chunk and we gained a chunk, but we need to be more worried about the chunk that we lost. And I think that's why Jeremy Corbyn coming in with such a radically different agenda is actually going to be positive for the Labour Party.
And obviously, having, I mean, moving back to yourself, I mean, you know, having stood once, do you fancy doing it again?
Well, having said, I always give a straight answer to a straight question. It's difficult because, you know, fixed term parliaments mean I don't know where I'm going to be in 4 years' time, life wise, starting a family, maybe job wise. But I'd absolutely love to, you know, love to stand again and to try and get selected. Probably I would have to say I would go for a more marginal seat. I think everyone who's interested in politics should stand for Parliament once, even if it's in a hopeless seat. But I think once in a hopeless seat is enough for me. But yeah, I'd absolutely love to get into Parliament one day.
That was Russell Whiting, who again stood in Suffolk Coastal. Some interesting points there, particularly around his view that Labour needs to show a sort of distinctive and different message to what it perhaps has been in the past. No doubt Jeremy Corbyn is doing so, and I suppose time will tell as to whether that's successful or not. Next up is James Frith, who, as I mentioned earlier, stood in the marginal seat of Bury North. And again, I started off by asking him a little bit about his background and how he got involved. So, James, thanks for joining me on Polling Matters. It'd be good, before we start our discussion, I guess, just to get a bit of background on you and kind of what you do in the day job, so to speak, and how you became a Labour candidate in Bury North in 2015.
Thank you, Kieran. Yeah, good to be here. Thanks for inviting me. So I worked in public and private sector for about 20 years. I moved to Manchester to study and to be closer to the Manchester scene, really, and indie music, which is a very much a passion of mine. And I've been in the skills and youth area of work for the last 10 years, including actually a stint working for the Labour Education Secretary, Ruth Kelly, in 2005. So I run my own business now, and fortunately took the decision to set up on my own, some might say fortunately, a month before selection proceedings happened in Bury North. So even with the journey, as it turned out to be a failed one, I was at least able to be my own boss during what was a pretty long 2-year campaign.
And presumably that gave you a lot more flexibility than maybe some of your other colleagues or sort of co-candidates might have had.
Definitely, and I was very conscious of that when I met with and continue to see, in fact, a number of other brilliant Labour candidates, and there were an absolutely incredible amount, wealth of talent on show at the general election for the Labour Party, and a lot of those candidates have had to dust their CV off and go and ask us to work for the man again, really. So I consider myself to be very fortunate that I run my own small business and employ others rather than seek employment as such.
And let's look at the campaign itself. I mean, when were you selected in relation to the election itself?
So I was selected in the June 2013, so it was a full 2 years running, but for the best part of 2 years before that, I was involved in, if you like, positioning to be a candidate in the town that I lived, in the town that I have family links to, of Bury. And so when the selection timetable was announced and, if you like, the starting pistol was fired, I'd done a lot of work in preparation for that in terms of my profile and my record of campaigning. I'd run the 2010 general election in Bury North as a volunteer. I was well known to the local national party, and I've been an active member for, since 2000, really, and a member of the party since then as well. So, and continue to be an active member. I think membership of a political party, I always believe to be different to that of membership of just a club or influencer. I think it is important to be active and not just a member of the Labour Party, and that's certainly my interpretation of, if you like, our obligation as members.
I'm just looking at, I've been doing some research, obviously, in the seat you stood, Bury North, as you've mentioned. I mean, David Chater was the MP there who ended up going to prison, I believe, due to the expenses scandal. I mean, that doesn't sound like a very easy seat for you to be standing in, given that sort of background of maybe a negative, well, not maybe, certainly a negative reputation of the past Labour MP.
Sure, that was certainly the case in 2010, but I received very little of that in 2015. I think both the coalition government in 2010 to 15 flushed out a lot of, if you like, reset British politics, and as a result, the exorcism of the 2010 campaign saw that people getting rid of their frustration and anger and disappointment actually hurt some of it in that instance, because he was a very well regarded local constituency MP. So in 2015 we were very much fighting a national reputation and need for assertion on economic credibility, leadership primarily, and immigration. So it wasn't really a local issue that we were up against.
Yeah, and I'll come back to the results in a moment, because obviously, as we all know, it was very, very close in the seat that you fought. But one of the areas I'm interested in is, you know, the people that stand for Parliament and how we can get a more representative Parliament in terms of the people that are in it. I mean, what are the pressures you experienced being a candidate in the run-up to 2015? As you mentioned, you were selected a good couple of years beforehand, and how well do you think this country, how capable do you think this country is at sort of getting lots of different people to stand?
Sure, there are, in my view, there's three huge pressures: the emotional pressure, the time pressure, and the money pressure. And I don't mean the campaign fundraising as much as I do just that if you spend 2 years of your life doing anything other than running your own business or being at work, there are going to be implications for that. The emotional side of things comes from the leadership that you have to show and the constant expectation that others have in you, which is absolutely fine, and I enjoy that, but nevertheless it is an emotional demand and not necessarily something that you can meditate on or reflect on ahead of it happening, and I would suspect that there are those that deal with that in different ways and deal with that in better and worse ways as well. The time pressures are enormous. I mean, I am a natural campaigner. I love to campaign and spent huge amounts of time on the doorstep. We spent time talking to over 30,000 people in Bury North in that time, and I was pretty much universally on every one of those door knocking sessions or street stalls or walkabouts. And then, as I've mentioned, the financial pressures, which is to say your life is on hold in many respects for that time. And that's not a criticism, certainly not a loan. I loved being the candidate and hope very much to be a candidate again. But those pressures are significant, and you are also in a small pool of people experiencing the same pressures, so that the support, if you like, the peer group support is small, although I met absolutely brilliant vast number of excellent candidates, fellow candidates, and there was a great deal of talent on show for the Labour Party at the 2015 general election. As to your point about representation, no, I don't think you struck the balance right. Yes, of course, we need parity of gender representation around for men and women in Parliament, and Labour is leading the way as ever on that issue. Same too for ethnic minority representation. But actually also, I welcome the comments Tom Watson made in his opening speech as the deputy leader about the need for us, the party, to relate to both private and public sector employees, but also entrepreneurs, small business owners. This is the engine room of the economy that we want to represent. We have to have to say to these people as
I'm just looking at the result from May. I mean, I might have got the numbers wrong, but it looks like you lost by 378 votes, something along those lines.
You got the that number is the sort of shadow that follows me around. The number 378 will appear to me as I move in the night.
Yeah. I suppose looking at the go on.
It was actually worse initially. It was 120, but the recount we were encouraged to ask for moved it from 120 to 378, which actually is a better number. 378 you can deal with. 120 feels like perhaps if we'd done one more session or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's interesting you can find 150 odd extra votes one way or the other in a recount, isn't it? But, I mean, looking at the result, I mean, I'm interested in getting your thoughts just, on why maybe the 300 odd votes was the wrong way round for you. I mean, I'm looking at the result here and UKIP have got more than 5,500 votes in May in the seat where you stood. The Greens over 1,000 and, of course, the Liberal Democrats less than 1,000 in fifth place behind the Greens. Substantial vote share loss for them. They'd achieved more than 7,500 votes in 2010. So as we saw in the rest of the country, I guess something of a Liberal Democrat collapse. Now, of course, in the ensuing Labour leadership race, and I guess it won't go away even beyond that from now on, there is an intense debate within the Labour Party in terms of why marginal seats went Conservative rather than Labour in different areas of the country. Some point to the fact that, Labour had this problem on the economy, or maybe Ed Miliband wasn't seen as a credible Prime Minister, and the rise of UKIP, which I guess is seen as in different ways to the left and the right of the party. Others look at, that if a few hundred of those Green votes had voted your way, maybe you would have taken the seat. And actually, turnouts was 67% almost, so there were plenty of non-voters there. I mean, you must have thought about this a lot. What's your interpretation of why you think the result went the wrong way for you? I mean, is there an answer, or is it just a sort of combination of several competing factors?
Ultimately, actually, we probably won the are going to appeal to marginal seat voters who ultimately deliver us the ability to be in power, delivering on those principles that we all cherish.
Yes, and I'm sure that's going to be a debate that carries on in the ensuing months and years. I mean, just to close, I mean, do you miss being a candidate? Have you had withdrawal symptoms, having been 2 years a candidate and now having to sort of settle back down to not being so, at least for the time being? That was James Frith. A big thanks to him there. Very, very interesting perspective. Again, interestingly, that he has a different view to Russell on why Labour lost. But what I think is actually perhaps more interesting with both of them is they're kind of saying quite similar things when you break it down, which is that regardless of your view of Jeremy Corbyn or whether Labour should move left or right, they're both kind of saying that Labour needs to offer something different and credible and ultimately offer the what it's going to do about things rather than merely pointing out that things are wrong. This is something I've said before, which I think is very much true, which is that Labour's never struggled to point out what's wrong with the Conservatives or what's wrong in our society and our politics, but where it maybe has struggled in the past is showing credibly that it has the ability to do something about it and to do something that is perceived by people that vote and particularly marginal seats to be credible. And I guess one person's perception of credibility is very different to other people's, but at the same time there's clearly an issue there that Labour has to look at in the future. I think this is going to be a topic we're going to return to in the future, because I think that there are so many different candidates who lost who you could speak to with different experiences. There's so many candidates who actually won and were successful. It'd be good to understand a bit more about people that actually get into Parliament and how they sort of transition. And it would even be great to speak to some people who lost their seats and how they adapt to life after politics, so to speak. But it's an ongoing thing, it's an important topic, because we obviously, I think, want to make sure we're getting not only the best and brightest into Parliament, but also people that reflect a diverse range of views or at least backgrounds. And if we think we're not achieving that at the moment, then clearly the logical conclusion to that is that we should be doing something about it. But that's it this week for this week's politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. In the coming weeks, we're going to be speaking about the US presidential election and also the EU referendum, so plenty to come. If you do like what you hear, do give us a share on Twitter or Facebook or anything else you can think of. And if you're on iTunes, do subscribe and leave us a rating, hopefully a positive one, on iTunes, and maybe a comment too. It really does help with putting us up the charts. We were actually as high as 64 this week on iTunes for news and politics, which was quite exciting, and we'd like to see if we can better that. So anything you guys can do that are listening would be fantastic. And the music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons. Again, thanks for listening. That was the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast.